Seattle's Morning News, and Hannah Scott has just walked into the studio. Sex education is now taught in high schools. The question now is, should it be taught in kindergarten? And it will be under a bill passed by the state Senate yesterday. So is this considered to be a huge change, just a tweak to the program, or what?
No, this is a pretty big deal. This is a big change. So right now there's a statewide curriculum for sex education, but it allows local control. Schools can opt out. Under this bill, sex ed would be mandated for all 6th through 12th graders by 2020. And by 2021, it would be mandated for all kindergarten through 12th grade students in public schools. Now, at a hearing last week, dozens came out in support.
As someone who was in an abusive relationship in high school, it is very difficult to know when you're getting into those situations. And if I would have had the knowledge of what those signs are, I think I could have avoided that.
All young people deserve an education that prioritizes their health and safety. One that does not pathologize their identity. One does that dismiss or ignore their lived reality.
A really effective way to prevent child sexual abuse is by teaching children about what that is.
Now, others spoke against the plan.
Are concerned that it is the legislature that will be mandating values by mandating comprehensive sex ed for all.
The Washington State is not honoring diversity, but cramming a solitary viewpoint upon all, regardless of their views, squashing diversity.
But State School Superintendent Chris Rakedale stressed to lawmakers that this was vital education for all kids.
When one-third of girls in our state walk out of high school and walk across the stage, and they've been sexually assaulted, they've been coerced, they've been forced into inappropriate touch, and one-sixth of our boys, we have a medical crisis. The linkages to suicide are real. The disproportionate impact of sexual assault for Native American girls, for the LGBTQ community, and students with disabilities is profound.
Now, that set up a heated, more than two-hour-long debate on the Senate floor yesterday, with Republicans firmly against this, offering more than a dozen amendments. None of those passed. Among the biggest criticisms is the inclusion of kindergarten through fifth grade students, as Republican Senator Randy Becker pointed to.
I also then think of when that little child comes home and it says, Mommy, Daddy, I had this class today. I'm scared to death. What is all this about? What is this about? I don't understand it, Mommy and Daddy. And they're going to be saying Mommy and Daddy because that's the age they are.
The next biggest issue, the fact that it takes away local control, according to Republican Senator Mike Patton.
What we're doing, we're telling a whole class of folks and citizens here, we as a state are rejecting your values.
But like every other Republican on the Senate floor yesterday, he was very passionate about this opposition.
I wish I could save some of my other no votes for other bills and put them all together and have 20 here. That's how strongly I feel about this.
But Democrats, including sponsor Lisa Wellman, said, look, we're talking about everything from teaching kids about inappropriate touching at a young age, gender identity, which is such a big thing, leads to bullying, in a lot of cases, suicide down the line. And also consent is a big part of this, depending on which grade level we're talking about. There was no way to look at what curriculum would be like. It requires Chris Rakedale, the officer of superintendent.
So we know how it's going to be done, because a lot depends on how it's approached, right?
Right. It'll be age appropriate, but it will become the state school superintendent will come up with what that's going to look like.
Well, I see a lot of problems for families who still, whatever you think, don't think homosexuality, for example, is something they want in their family. So they would be upset about that. My other question is this based on some sort of research showing that if they do this, it would, in fact, reduce bullying and these other problems?
I think that's just a belief that there's, you know, different studies were pointed to that in other states where they letting people know and teaching at nobody's done this from an early age, I don't think, at this point, starting at kindergarten. The belief is that the more informed students are, the more accepting that they will be. But like you just pointed out, their values are a big issue. And we did hear a lot in the hearing that I watched, and then also heard from many of the Republicans from east of the Cascades yesterday, that their constituents don't agree with this and don't have these values and don't want their kids exposed to it.
So this would literally have time set aside in kindergarten for sex education, however that's defined. I thought the general thinking now was you wait until kids start asking the questions. And the difference between the way we do it now and the way we did it when I was young in the 50s is that if a kid asks a question at the age of six, you answer it. That's all. because the fact that they answer the question indicates that they're curious and are ready for it, rather than saying, okay, kid, we're sitting you down at the age of six to tell you this.
Not good enough, according to the lawmakers behind this bill. Not good enough. We need to change our culture, get this education out there again, starting at an early age. And I do want to stress that, this, they say, will be very age appropriate, right? It's not like you're going to be teaching kindergartners about condoms and STDs and things like that.
When they say age appropriate, are they going to reveal the details of what that means before they vote on the bill? Or do you pass this as a requirement first and then they come up with the curriculum?
No, the curriculum will become, it doesn't have to be done until 2021.
So people would have to vote on this before knowing what it is actually going to look like.
Lawmakers will have to vote on this beforehand.
Yeah. So do you think it has a chance of passing?
I do. It cleared the Senate on a full party line vote yesterday. Yeah. It was Democrats all for it, all Republicans against. And with the majority that we have in the Senate, in the House, which is even larger, I think it's probably likely. We'll see. It still has to go through that process. I think it's very likely that this will pass. And, you know, as a mom myself, I'll tell you, I talked to my daughter about this last night when I was watching the Senate. And she learned in sixth grade, was her first sex education class. It was here in the state. And she came home and it was in that grade, it was all about gender identities, right? Her and all of her friends, though, immediately then kind of started labeling themselves. My daughter thought she came home and she told me she was a lesbian in sixth grade. She doesn't think she is now, but it was. So I questioned at the time, is it the fact that those ideas are planted? And I heard those arguments yesterday. I don't think so. Most of those students have since changed their mind. Her friends are now they don't really label themselves. But then she said now she's a freshman in high school. And I asked her, I said, what did you learn last year and what did you learn this year? She was horrified by the stuff she learned. But is it important for her to know some of these things?
Yeah.
I think so. I'm on the fence about this bill. I really am. I get where they're coming from. I get why it's important. And I know that kids can be horrible and mean and bully. And especially when we're talking about transgender students, I think it's important. I want my daughter to know what consent is. I want her to know who should and should not be allowed to be near her or touch her.
You know, the most shocking to me is that you and your daughter sit down and watch legislative hearings together.
I'm getting her in young.
That's more shocking than the curriculum. We go to Vietnam.
We actually had papers ready to be signed, but it just wasn't appropriate. I want to do it right. I'd much rather do it right than do it fast.
Sometimes you have to walk. The president's summit with Kim Jong-un ended without a deal to create a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy is still in Hanoi. We asked him if there's any indication that yesterday's Michael Cohen testimony was the reason that these talks did not reach an agreement.
Well, that's a very interesting theory. I don't think that's it, but the president did make a point of saying that he was watching the Michael Cohen testimony, which would have aired in the middle of the night here in Hanoi, Vietnam, and he said it was a terrible thing that the quote-unquote fake hearing would take place while he's having this very important meeting with Kim Jong-un. The suggestion there being that the Democrats in the House did this to him to try to derail this summit or something along those lines. The president essentially conveyed that he had that on his mind while he was meeting with Kim Jong-un, but I don't think it's the reason that the president wasn't able to reach an agreement with Kim Jong-un. What we're hearing from administration officials is that the North came in expecting that the U.S. would lift the sanctions. They offered to dismantle the Yongbyong nuclear facility, which is a big deal, but not nearly enough. I mean, you heard Secretary say Pompeo talk about the need for the North Koreans to be much more forthcoming about their overall nuclear and missile program and to talk about dismantling all of that. And that was not on the table.
So the next step now, he says that they left on good terms, indicating that this does not begin another stretch of missile testing, presumably. What are people saying about that?
One thing the president can say that he's taking away from this is the continued promise from the North Koreans not to conduct any more nuclear or missile tests. What we have to see, what we have not seen yet, as you and I are speaking, Dave, is some kind of statement from the North Korean government, either through their official state media or other channels, as to how this is being viewed by Pyongyang. We've heard from the president. We have not yet heard from Chairman Kim. The president was asked about the prospect of future meetings with Kim. He pointedly refused to answer questions about that. One of the things that the White House was hoping to have here in Pyongyang, besides an agreement on a definition as to what denuclearization means and the disclosure of facilities, also a framework for future talks. They don't have that.
One thing that jumped out from the New York Times article, anyway, was the number of nuclear warheads that North Korea apparently has, between 30 and 60. I thought it was a handful. That's the highest number I've seen.
Several dozen now, it seems. And one of the things that one of my colleagues made a really smart point, and that is that one thing that Kim Jong-un can say is that he's bought some time, right?
Yeah.
It was 8 months ago that the Singapore summit took place, and then, now here we are today. There's been no real substantive progress to denuclearize. How much more progress did the North Koreans make to nuclearize?
So in the event that Kim resumes testing, what's your sense? Do we let it pass because we're good buddies and it's probably just a misunderstanding? Or do we say enough is enough and start blowing things up?
Well, that's why the risk is, and I'm not suggesting that this is the most likely outcome, but one risk is that both sides retrench, the rhetoric ramps back up, the intelligence community continues to illustrate how the North Koreans are continuing to ramp up their nuclear prowess, and we get closer to war, not further away. The president has tried to say that the situation has improved, that the hostages have been released, and the POW remains have been returned, and there hasn't been testing. Well, now he's had this big summit. We all flew here to Vietnam, and the president had dinner with Kim Jong-un. They never got to lunch. The lunch was canceled.
CBS's Stephen Portnoy joining us from Hanoi, and joined now by Larry Maggott, who is CBS's tech news analyst and also consults with the tech companies about keeping kids safe online. And he was here for an appearance at Microsoft. Is the food still all free over there?
No, I asked that. It's not all free. I had a very nice meal that somebody bought me. But unlike Silicon Valley, where certainly at Facebook and Google, things are free. In fact, socialism has come to Silicon Valley if you work for one of these companies. I mean, it's amazing. But no, I think they do have to pay at Microsoft.
Well,
coffee's free, though.
How things change.
Yeah.
Oh, the free coffee. That's a nice little perk. Yeah. So we were talking about this. Apparently, an anti-war caucus at Microsoft, which is upset over a contract for $479 million to produce augmented reality systems for the military. What's behind that?
Well, just as a review, augmented reality is like virtual reality, except you can see through the glasses, the HoloLens. And I could see why the military would love HoloLens, because you could actually be on a battle situation and see what you need to see and still see the enemy or whatever it is you're looking at. It's great for fixing things, mechanics to fix devices. But what's behind the protest is that there are employees at Microsoft, just as there are at Google, and we had a similar situation in my area around Google wanting to build robotics and sending those over to the military. There are folks that believe that what the military is doing is wrong and that Microsoft shouldn't be collaborating. And there was a similar protest, I understand, around Microsoft working with ICE around something. I don't know exactly the details. But it's a real question. Look, Microsoft CEO says that this is a democratic country and the military is here to defend democracy and we have a right and a responsibility to help. The employees say no, what the military is doing is evil and the company should not collaborate.
Where do you draw the line here? Because I'm sure the military has been using Microsoft operating systems for years,
forever.
as every other branch of the U.S. government.
And every other government, for that matter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how do you decide who you're not going to sell to when everybody's already got your stuff?
Well, it's a very important decision that a company has to make. But I do know at Google, when the employees made enough noise, the company backed away and canceled its contract with the Defense Department. Whether that was because the executives felt that was the right thing to do or just wanted to appease the employees, I'm not sure about. But this is a line that, I guess it's up to the conscience of any one person to decide or any one entity to decide. I still remember the Vietnam War, and there was a lot of legitimate protest not wanting to collaborate. We're not in the same place today, but there are certainly a lot of people who feel very strongly that they shouldn't be collaborating with the military.
That was a big deal. Many of my fellow physics majors just dropped out because they were accused of being collaborators.
Right. Yeah. So I was a sociology major, so we were actually encouraged to protest the war. No, we weren't encouraged. We were certainly allowed to.
All right. Policing these online services like Facebook, the FTC apparently has started a task force to examine which of these sites are too powerful.
Yeah. All of them. This is not at all a surprise. I think that the handwriting has been on the wall ever since certainly the 2016 election and the Russian interference and all the hoopla about privacy and all the consolidation when you think about Facebook buying WhatsApp, buying Instagram, Google buying up companies. The Federal Trade Commission and other agencies are going to be taking very hard looks at tech, a look at tech. There is a tech lash or a tech backlash. And here in Seattle, you have a couple of big companies that have suffered, mostly Amazon, from a tech backlash. We're going to see a lot of that. And I think by the end of this Congress, we will see some very serious legislation that's going to put the reins on tech companies.
In what way? Because Amazon, as big as it is, still doesn't have monopoly power, right? I mean, and that's where when federal regulation kicks in, isn't it?
Right, although some would argue that its impact on retail, it may be not monopoly, but it is
predatory.
A behemoth. Yeah, they're arguing predatory power. But certainly when you look at situations at Facebook, the privacy issues, when you look at all of the issues of Google, lots of privacy issues, there will be privacy legislation. Europe has already come down hard with their general data privacy regulation rules, very restrictive rules around privacy. California has put in some rules. We're going to see federal rules as well.
Is it all about privacy? Because it seems to me Facebook's problem is they basically have set up a broadcast company and then just let anybody to walk in off the street and broadcast to the world without editing.
Well, that's true, and that's another issue which has to do with what is the responsibility for Facebook. There was a big deal earlier, I guess it was last year, around the Communications Decency Act, which actually enabled Facebook to say, hey, it's not our fault that somebody posted something that's hateful or sexual or whatever. You know, we're just a platform. But then the question is, what is their responsibility? So you're right. There's more than 2 billion people that are contributing content. Could you imagine if radio stations operated?
That's what I mean. They've got, by orders of magnitude, a bigger audience than we do.
Sure.
And we're under severe restrictions over...
Well, but we're also over the air. But so they're more analogous to a cable.
You know, that's become almost an insignificant distinction anymore.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true.
Actually, so are they. I mean, every time you log on to Facebook from your mobile app, it's over the air.
But it's data. So there's, you know, again, it's a technical issue. No. But the bottom line is you're absolutely right. Social media is bigger than traditional media, probably has more influence, yet doesn't have regulations. And a lot of people, at the very least, want to have fair advertising rules on social media, similar to radio and television and even print, which isn't regulated by the Federal Communications Commission.
That's the other thing. Fake Amazon reviews.
Yeah.
Gaming Amazon reviews.
Yep.
The FTC is worried about that, too.
Sure.
that seems to be impossible. If you're saying, please review this product, I've seen where they have reviewed, they verify that somebody actually purchased the product, so you've got that. But what's to prevent somebody from just making it up?
Oh, it's very difficult. And, you know, the FTC actually has rules for bloggers. I'm not sure that many actually follow them. As a blogger is required, is supposed to disclose if they get a freebie.
Yeah.
So what's happening is moms are getting baby carriages.
Like if you're a competitor and you go out to trash your competition.
Yeah, no, I remember somebody wrote a very, very obscure book and had hundreds of reviews, all positive. And I'm thinking, I can't even imagine she sold 20 copies of this book. Yeah. How could she have hundreds of reviews?
Yeah. What is TikTok? T-I-K-T-O-K.
TikTok used to be called Musical.ly. And it's a video service that's very popular among young people. Its big thing is kids lip sync video, although you can do other things with it. Very popular among young people. And the problem that TikTok ran into with the Federal Trade Commission is that they were allowing children under 13 to sign up without parental permission. And that's a violation of something called the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA, that requires that permission. So the company paid a record $5.7 million fine and has supposedly cleaning itself up. And I actually noticed they linked to my website, connectsafely.org, which is very nice of them, probably because they now feel that they've got to look good from a safety and children's standpoint.
So what was unsafe about it?
It wasn't necessarily unsafe. It's just that the COPPA requires parental permission for any kind of personal information from a child. That would be their name, their email address, or the video itself. If they're under 13, parents have to give permission. So it's more of a privacy issue, but there could be some safety issues as well.
I wanted to ask you one more thing, and that is Amazon's decision not to lease that big new building being built downtown at Rainier Square.
Wait, are we in Seattle or New York?
We're in Seattle.
Oh, this is not about Queens, right?
No.
Okay, just want to be sure about that.
Queens made its feelings very well known. Of course, that building was also wrapped up in the whole controversy here around the head tax, where Amazon threatened to stop construction. So they resumed construction on one, but they decided not to use their lease on another. So what's your take? Is that could this be the end of the office boom in Seattle, or is Amazon expanding as quickly as ever?
Well, as I'm reading it, they could be expanding into the suburbs. So I guess that certainly benefits the greater Seattle area. But I'll tell you something. You know, Amazon development is a mixed blessing. I live in Silicon Valley. My daughter teaches school, so not only can she not afford to buy a house, but she happens to teach in a low-income community, and the people who used to live in her community, who used to go to her school, are having to move tens and twenties and dozens of miles away because it's too close to Facebook, where there are a lot of high-paid people who can bring up the rents and the housing prices. So it's a mixed blessing, depending on where you are on the economic ladder.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Yeah, I'm sure you know. Yeah,
that is the whole issue here. And do you think, do these companies feel they have an obligation to do something about that, or is that just the market?
I don't know about Amazon. Facebook certainly pays lip service to it. They built a dog park in the low-income community. Well, that doesn't really benefit people who can't afford to live there, but the dogs are happy.
Larry Magid, CBS tech analyst. Thanks, Larry.
My pleasure.
But a dose of kindness. Bill Waldschmidt's automotive shop, it looks very different today. The Minnesota man, he spent his life fixing up classic cars. But now he works on some smaller machines, but for a very good cause. First, a little bit about Bill. As a child, he contracted polio.
I was in the hospital for several months. We were quarantined, and I remember looking out there and seeing mom and dad and grandpa and grandma looking through the window at me.
He worked his whole life regaining strength and was able to walk down the aisle with his bride. But then at the age of 60, he developed post-polio. The symptoms came back. He would be in an electric wheelchair from here on out. That got in the way of fixing up classic cars. So he found a new hobby. He'd put his mechanic skills to work and fix up used electric chairs like his, but to give to others, like this disabled Vietnam vet.
I've never had a gift like this, never. He's the kindest man on the planet that I've ever met. He does all this out of his heart, just out of his kindness of his heart.
Boyd Hupert from Care 11 News in Minnesota is behind this story today.
Is it as satisfying as fixing those cars up? Way more satisfying. Life has been really good to me, so I got to pass it on, you know.
He puts a lot of work into those wheelchairs, too. He takes donations from all over. Not just fixes them up, but he polishes them, cleans them. Says nobody wants to sit in a dirty chair. I mean, he really delivers.
Take pride in your work.
Yeah, top-notch quality product.
Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is from that happy hayride of sports, 710 ESPN Seattle. And this is the official end of the Legion of Boom?
Yes.
Earl Thomas is gone?
Yes. It ended in Arizona week
Cam
three.
Cam Chancellor is gone?
Cam Chancellor's retired, won't be able to play football again. Richard Sherman's in San Francisco, currently recruiting Earl Thomas to try to get him to San Francisco, but we all knew Earl was leaving.
Did we?
Yeah.
I don't remember this.
When you flip off the general manager on your way off the field after breaking your leg, that's a pretty good sign that you're probably antagonistic toward the team that was employing you.
I've forgotten about that.
Yeah, it's probably a pretty good sign that you're not real interested in coming back. They didn't extend his contract. They didn't. At a point where he held out, he wasn't present through training camp. He showed up right before the start of the season, and then unfortunately he got hurt. But the chances of him, even if he'd played the full season, coming back were less than 5%.
And he's been very cryptic on Twitter, too. 3 days ago, just tweeting, "Let it all work out, Wayne," with some musical notes. And then 2 days ago, still looking for ways to get better. Just, you know, dot, dot, dot.
Yes.
So we kind of knew this was coming.
Motivational. Yes. He's the one that's not considering coming back to Seattle. His contract is done. The Seahawks didn't have a chance to retain him. When he showed up last year, he released a statement that said, "The disrespect has been well noted and will not be forgotten," because the team wouldn't extend his contract. Yeah. This is not any sort of sudden revelation that he is almost certainly headed out the door. The question is now, does he go to Dallas, which is the team he grew up cheering for and whose locker room he went into after a game in 2017? You remember that?
That too.
If you all want get a chance, y'all come get me.
All the clues are there.
That's correct. So all of these things, if you add up all of the weird stuff that's happened with Earl, it's pretty weird.
How does that happen? I mean, has it been 3 years since the Super Bowl win?
Well, five.
Has it been five?
2013 season, January 2014.
Time is moving a little too fast for me. But still, 5 years later, and it just seems like all the relationships that were so tight-knit have crumbled. All of the graciousness that we saw has gone away. I mean, it really just devolved into what's there to show for this big win.
It's a nature of sports Well, there's a trophy and there's a championship that won't ever be forgotten. And in 4 or 5 years, these guys will start coming back to have their numbers put up in the Ring of Honor. Yeah. To be honored
you
as the
greatest. Think all will be
space.
Healed in a few years?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the only question I have is Marshawn Lynch. Marshawn's pretty stubborn, and I'm not, but I think ultimately he will end up coming back and being honored here. But all the other guys, that's where Earl Thomas played his best football. I mean, he played 9 seasons here. He's an incredible player.
Because I don't like these sort of icky feelings.
Well, you know, the Beatles, 5 years from Ed Sullivan to break up.
Is that what it was?
No. Yeah.
Just 5 years?
64 to 69.
Good perspective.
Yeah. So, Doug Baldwin, what's his future?
I expect him to be back. He was pretty beat up last year, and I think there are questions about how long his body's going to hold up, but he came back and he was performing pretty well at the end of the season. I think the Seahawks have every expectation that he's going to be back. If he doesn't come back, it would be his decision.
All right, so the Russell Wilson update. It's still radio silence?
Well, they're talking.
You're not allowed to ask until July, Dave.
Yeah, that's true. I did put the moratorium on
it. Is that
what
you said?
I said we're not going to worry about it because it's going to be a conversation point between then and here and then. And there's rumors that he's going to be with the New York Giants and all of these things. It's not going to get done before July. We should all be prepared to hang out for a lot more. Yeah. Oh, what are they doing? How close are they? How big the contract does he want? Why haven't they done it yet?
In the meantime, just enjoy the bedroom videos he's posting. And he's posting videos and pictures of him and Sierra in bed.
There was quite a revealing photo he published. I believe it was on Instagram. Somebody showed it to me yesterday of Sierra.
That'll keep us busy till July.
Yeah, if you want to talk, Brock and Salk were concerned
I'm
about
following him. The wrong people.
Brock and Salk were concerned that he might be a little chubby. There was a video that he posted.
Well, it's off season.
The morning. Yeah. He was swollen. Yeah. It's fine.
He was a little chubby.
Oh, wait.
Water weight?
She
was talking about water weight.
I'm pregnant, see, and I That's wake right. up and my fingers look like sausages. So, different perspective.
He had a wig on and he was running around, and Brock and Salk were worried that he might be a little heavy, which I was like, no. I thought it was remarkable that he was showing a human side of his personality.
I'm going to show myself out. Yeah.
Okay, so I was going to talk about the combine, but I don't think Colleen can go on.
The Underwear Olympics?
Yeah. Miles Gaskin, Gardner, Mustache Minshew, Jake Browning, Taylor Rapp. So are we going to pick up a Husky, you think?
I don't know. It's a decent shot. They got one last year in Will Disley, the tight end. There's nine different Huskies that are there at the scouting combine.
Yeah.
The likelihood of it, if they could, they're not going to have a chance to draft Byron Murphy. Man, if they did, I'd love to see what they do with him. He's a cornerback. He's probably going to be the first Husky chosen. Uh-huh. And he is an athlete and an absolute, he's a hitter. I think he would thrive in the Seahawks defense.
Byron Murphy. He could take Richard Sherman's place?
Yeah. Yes. Really? He is that kind of athlete. He is a competitive. And from the first time I saw him, he only played 2 seasons with the Huskies because they redshirted him. And apparently not realizing that they should have played him when he was a true freshman because he wasn't going to stick around for 4 seasons of college football. Oh. But, man, I've loved the way he plays. He goes after the ball. He scored the touchdown in the Pac-12 championship game, an extreme moment of conversation. He's the best cornerback ever to come out of Washington.
Danny O'Neill, our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. Thanks, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Choke Points. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. The state is about 2 years into the massive renovation of Coleman Dock in downtown Seattle. The price tag continues to go up, up, up. And why is that, Chris Sullivan?
Well, there are a couple of factors. One of them is the state says, the ferry system says that the legislature didn't fully fund it. But one of the primary reasons for the increase is that they say the tariffs put on the foreign steel by the Trump administration has caused their prices to go up. And to reset the stage on that, the 25% tariffs went into effect last year. And because of that, U.S. steel prices actually jumped significantly. They have since returned to pre-tariff levels. But despite that return in prices, the head of the state ferry system, Amy Scarton, blames those increased U.S. steel prices for pushing the price tag to retrofit Coleman Dock into the red. The ferry system says it has seen a 24% increase in their steel costs.
We have seen quite a bit of cost increase in those steel prices just since last fall, when I believe the tariffs went up. So that is probably the number one cost driver of the section of our request that is asking for a cost increase. It's steel.
So Skarton went to the Senate Transportation Committee this week to ask for another $95 million to finish this project. 60 of that is, they say, the allocation that didn't fully fund the project initially. The rest of it can be made up of some of those steel tariff prices that they're paying.
It did not fund everything we needed to get done in the project over 6 years. It essentially funded what we needed in that first biennium to get the project started.
So now the project is estimated to cost $468 million.
Can I just ask you a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
So was there a misunderstanding over what they were appropriating at the beginning? I mean, it's one side seems to think that this was the total budget for the project. The other side is saying, no, it wasn't.
It's when you get into the minutiae of the language and the way these kind of mega projects, even though this one, you know, I mean, anything you costs over 100 and this was at 468 now, they fund things at 30% design, 60% design, 90% design, and then completion. So the original 300 or so million that they went for and they got a couple years ago was at 30% design looking forward going ahead. But then during that time frame, interim, you know, they come across things like, oh, maybe we needed a permit here that we didn't realize, or we needed a land use thing that we weren't anticipating here. Maybe, oh, the steel prices went up. And so they fund these things not at completion, or initially, they fund them at 30%.
Basically, design. What we're saying is the initial no project ever has an initial price that's going to hold firm through the life of the project.
That is correct.
So why do we keep saying it's over budget when that's really not news? Every single project, because of the nature of the beast, apparently, will always be over budget by that definition.
It seems that way, unless someone were to come out and say it's only going to cost X. When this one was done, and the way a lot of things are handled in this state through the legislature, they funded at certain levels based on their anticipation going forward, and then they find things. And to your point, Senator Curtis King was like, listen, why can't you control these costs?
We were below $300 million. The way I feel about it is, we funded it at the 30% design, and then everybody just designed it the way they wanted it designed, and there was not a lot of care in regards to cost.
And that's what, a lot of complaints like, oh, well, you're building the Taj Mahal of this. Everyone accuses the state generally of buying the most expensive option for it.
Why don't they design the whole thing first and then say, okay, this is what that would cost. Are you going to give us that money? And then it's a yes or no. And if they say no, we just let the old ferry dock collapse in the next earthquake.
Well, some projects are funded that way. They are moving, though, to this design build concept where you fund at what you think so you can get the ball rolling, because it can be hard to get appropriations.
But once you get the ball rolling, you can't stop it no matter what the cost.
I know. The next thing you know, you've got all this fabulous artwork that doesn't do anything to
the artwork
is. But what you know, I know that's a red herring for this discussion and other things. So the complaint is, oh, well, you're doing so much for bikes and doing so much for this. And then this lobby wanted this. Nicole McIntosh, she's an engineer for the ferry system. She said, listen, we are cognizant of cost.
We do, as we go through design, look at practical design. And like the terminal building that we're building in this is actually smaller than what we have today because we right-sized it, which is in our attempt to minimize the costs.
Either way, the project is now going to cost another $95 million. The project should be finished in 2023. And here's all hoping that we don't have a moderate earthquake between now and then.
Yes.
Because
that old one is in bad shape.
Yeah, I feel bad just walking on that. I feel bad parking my car there. I'm like, is this thing going to hold up? It's not that bad, but
can't just put the whole thing
shape
on floats? Take one of the old pontoons from the old 520 bridge?
Though they sold those.
They did?
Right. Yeah, they sold all those.
Seattle's Morning News. Good morning, Rachel.
Good morning, Dave.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah, good to see you too.
For those who don't know, Rachel is a James Beard Almost Award winner. And so she's plugged
AKA
in.
Nominee.
She's plugged into the James Beard Food Awards. And we have the restaurant semifinalists now?
Yeah. So yesterday, the big list was announced. And for people who don't know the James Beard Awards, this is the Oscars of the food industry. So there's two categories, chefs and restaurants, and then media. And so the chef and restaurant category was announced yesterday. And if you're nominated, this is a huge deal.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like a Michelin star kind of thing.
It's a national thing, right?
It's a national thing, yes. So I wanted to just talk about some of the restaurants that are on this list, because for people who care, it's very exciting. And some of these are in a local category, like they have a Pacific Northwest category, and some of them are national. I am excited to read that the best new restaurant nominee is Sawyer, which is a semi-new restaurant in the Ballard neighborhood of Seattle. This is in the national category, and I've only eaten there once, but I have told everybody I know that it was the best meal from a new restaurant I've had in years. It's like a very playful Pacific Northwestern food. So the thing that's most memorable is a dessert they do that is a fancy take on the Choco Taco. This has edible flowers on it.
I love the Choco
Taco. But it still looks like a Choco. It is delicious. So I was excited to see that the restaurant I was most excited about got a national nominee. Some names that I think most people might know in the area. Ethan Stowell got an outstanding restaurateur nominee for the national awards. And then locally
he does the food for the Mariners, right?
He does do the food for the Mariners. And in about a month, I do my annual trek down to, what's it called now? T-Bone Stadium?
Yeah, T-Bone. They rejected Strip Steak Stadium and they went for T-Bone.
T-Ball Stadium? I don't remember. T-Mobile Stadium.
Yes.
Every year.
Now. It's Magenta, sorry.
Yes, they have an event every year where they announce the new food that they're going to serve for Mariner season. And for the past several years, Ethan Stoll has done that menu.
Yeah.
So looking forward to chatting with him. Maybe he's going to step it up because of the nominee. But, you know, some predictable stuff on here. Canlis is nominated for outstanding service. Mm-hmm. And then locally, it's kind of interesting to see what restaurants get nominated, because it kind of shows, in my opinion, the kind of foods that Seattleites eat. And so I am not surprised to see that it leans very Asian heavy.
Yeah.
I'm most excited about Rachel Yang and Saif Shershi. They own one of my favorite restaurants, Revel, but they're nominated for their restaurant Jewel, which is an excellent restaurant here in Seattle. And then my friend Taichi Kitamura, who has a Japanese restaurant right down the street from Cairo Radio called Sushi Kapo Tamura, one of my favorite Japanese restaurants in the city. And a new place called Homer, which is doing fancy Middle Eastern food in the Central District. Or
so how many nominees are there in all nationwide?
You know? Ooh, for the whole, total or for the local people?
Just total nationwide. I mean, how big a field is this?
Oh, it's huge. I don't even know. I was scanning down the email.
Yeah. So as you win this is a big deal.
This is a big deal. And so I'm telling people, go online. We'll get this up at mynorthwest.com. Go online and check out these restaurants and go now, because you won't be able to get in. So last year, Eduardo Jordan, who is a Seattle chef, he won best chef in the country. And one of his restaurants won best restaurant in some category. My friends went last week. It's been a year since the James Beard Awards. They had to wait an hour and a half to get in.
Thanks.
An amount of time that I would not have waited to get in. So go now or forever hold your peace.
That's right. Nobody goes there. It's too crowded.
It is.
Okay. One of the things, though, and this is a controversy that popped up last week, is that more and more restaurants are getting noisier and noisier because they're using all these hard materials. What's the reason that every restaurant now sounds like a bus station?
Yeah, there's an article in the Seattle Times that's talking about the fact that restaurants are getting louder. And I've read national articles about this as well. So you'll notice in Seattle, especially with all this new building, all the buildings look the same. They're very modern. And both the modern architecture and current modern style decor leans very hard surface heavy. You know, like back in the day, I mean, before my generation, you would go and there'd be these drapes. This was like a sign of beauty. Tablecloths and carpets and like a padded seat. You know, you don't have that anymore. Everything is cement and wood and metal. And a lot of these, you know, there's all these condo buildings that have restaurants in the bottom level.
Right.
And you look up and you can see the pipes.
Ductwork. Yes.
And so all of this means that there's nothing to absorb any sound. So it has nothing to do with the music being too loud or people talking too loud. It's these materials. I mean, there's that kind of balance between you don't want to be in a silent restaurant because you want some atmosphere. And also myself, I'm kind of loud and sometimes inappropriate. And I hate when it's so quiet that I feel like everyone can hear my conversation and I have to whisper.
Oh, you love it.
But then again, yeah, you don't want this loud restaurant. So if you want a quiet place to eat, think of a place that's kind of old school that still uses fabric in its decor.
You can also download the I Hear You app, which was developed at the UW, which can record the decibel level of the restaurant you're sitting at. So you can discern whether you're actually doing any damage to your ears.
So it's kind of like wearing a Fitbit. Basically, it's like going to do it anyway, but now you know it's bad for you.
Exactly. Guy Radio's Rachel Bell. Her James Beard Award nominated podcast is called Your Last Meal, and you can find it at mynorthwest.com.